Real life
superpowers.
Becoming a mother humbled me in a way that I understood that you cannot control the outcome. You can only control what you know at a certain time and do your best. If you did your best, then that's all. And I think that's the essence of being a CEO, a COO, an entrepreneur, is making decisions, making them quickly, learning from them quickly, and being humble enough to know that you can't control all outcomes.
Hey, everyone. In this episode of Real Life Superpowers, we speak with Miri Yudovich, co-founder and now CEO of Safehouse Tech, a cybersecurity company on a mission to secure everyone online. Prior to becoming CEO, she was the COO of Safehouse Tech. Under Miri's leadership, Safehouse's flagship app has achieved rapid growth, protecting over 4 million users since its 2019 launch, turning the company break-even by 2024. She's also helped build an extensive distribution network of 5,000 retail outlets across more than 700 cities, making cutting-edge digital protection accessible to people far and wide. The app's success is a game-changer, redefining how everyday users safeguard their digital lives. Join us as we explore Miri's journey and uncover the superpowers behind her success.
Real life
superpowers. Superpowers.
Miri, welcome.
Hey.
Hi, Renee, and hi, Noah. Thank you for having me.
We're happy to. What's taking up your headspace these days?
So these days, most of my headspace is dedicated towards building new channels in our startup. We've been running for about 7 years now, and we've built a very cool product that is protecting digital lives of people. And the way we did it is we went for a very unusual go-to-market, and this is a B2B2C. And it was very surprising to a lot of people that we chose that way. And now, after 7 years, we're actually trying to go full on B2C. So direct to consumer, meeting people online where they actually purchase and have it.
Tell me about the product.
Yeah, so the product is it's a digital platform. It's an app. We also have a browser extension and SDKs that we sell. And the main selling point and the main value that the product brings to customers is the ability to provide them with online safety. And I mean everyone. When we started the company, it was kind of weird to us that we can sell super intelligent cyber technologies to companies, to governments, but we can't protect our own sort of digital lives. And if you think about it, like most of your assets today is online. You have your phone, you have your Instagram, you have your podcasts, you have all your assets online and nothing to protect them. In the 1990s, it was called antiviruses. But in nowadays, you need something in between you and the internet to sort of help you bridge that gap. And this is what we're trying to do. So we're trying to provide this first layer of interaction between yourself and the online. And take it as a simple example. You get a text message saying, hey, I got a great deal in Target, or I got a great deal in some other retailer or whatever else. And it's basically a phishing attempt. It's a phishing attempt. It's a phishing attack. And it basically tries to lure you into giving your details. We blocked many of those and many of other online scams, and basically tried to give people this sort of seatbelt for them in their online engagements.
Is this your first rodeo?
This is the first time that I've started my own company. I've actually joined two founders about 6 months after they started. I started my journey here at Safe House as a co-founder and a COO. So I was actually looking at the entire operational space, everything from the business, the finance, how we approach customers, how we engage with customers. So I built the entire funnel, the entire ecosystem. And about a year and a half ago, I started, I actually became the CEO. So for me, the main thing that kind of drove me was to do things with my own hands. I wanted to feel what it's like that you have nothing and then you say, oh, I'm gonna set up something. And then slowly you start believing yourself and then it actually starts happening. And I think this is what really kind of drove me to it, drove me to become an entrepreneur.
What were you doing before? Like, what led to this? I understand the sort of feeling, but it must have evolved through something. So
100%. So I actually started my career as an investment banker on the dark side. and what I was doing is I was helping founders, usually at later stages, let's say B and onwards, prepare for IPOs, prepare for large fundraisings, cross-border. So I was doing it in a bank in London called Charles Street Securities. And there, of course, I was very young. I just graduated from university. And I found myself, you know, helping these startups do something that I've never done with my own hands. So at first, it felt to me like, who am I to sort of help these people? And with time, what I learned is to actually dive into an industry. So it takes me about 3 weeks, or it used to take me about 3 weeks to sort of dive into an industry and completely understand it, the competitors, the technology, and all the aspects. And after about 4 years or 4.5 years of doing that, I said to myself, okay, there's a limit to how much I can advise. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed being a part of someone else's journey. And I started getting the itch, but actually I didn't really feel comfortable enough. I was still young. And I said, if I don't feel comfortable enough right now, what would make me feel utmost comfortable? So I said to myself, I want to be in a room where decisions are made. So I then became the assistant of Eyal Waldman, who was the founder and CEO of Mellanox before it turned into NVIDIA. And actually, I found myself sitting at the table. I didn't mind it. Of course, I was not leading the conversation or doing anything, but I was just a fly on the wall. And for me, that was the top business school. For me, I felt like that's where I actually learned to tell right from wrong, and to do business in an upscale, in the most sort of straightforward way. I saw how very hard decisions were being taken. And sort of after a year and a half, I decided that that I'm ready.
But how did you land that job in the first place? Because not many people get an opportunity to get a seat at that table or the likes of it.
True. To be fair, I just saw a post of a friend of mine who was an HR VP on Facebook. Oh. And I said, look, I'm an ex-investment banker. Eyal wanted someone with like an MBA or a business background. And I said, you know, I think I can do it. Of course, it's a 30-70 or 70-30 of things that are very, very hard to do, and things that I actually enjoy doing. And for me, that was like, you know, the best thing that happened to me. I remember that I came to the interview and Eyal asked me, how many mistakes do I do? And I was like, okay, I'm starting to understand where I'm entering. And he was utmost serious. So I took a second and I was like, you know, I never do the same mistake twice. So if I do a mistake, I try to correct it, but I never do the same mistake twice. And that was the end of the conversation and I got the job.
Fascinating. I was going in my head in very different directions. I was sort of telling myself, perhaps he's seeking somebody who is a risk taker, although I don't know if that's what you would look for in that position. But I was thinking he's trying to understand how conservative you are and would want somebody who is actively making mistakes, you know, moving fast, breaking walls type of mindset. So that wasn't the case, huh?
So it was in a sense, but from a very different perspective. It was like someone that can think of every possible thing that can happen and then do the next thing to try and avoid it. So basically be prepared for whatever is happening today, but whatever can happen tomorrow and the day after as well. And for me, it was, you know, when I heard it for the first time, when I heard that question, I was like, okay, for me, it felt intense. I understood that it's a very, very intense work environment and an intense pace, which is actually very similar to investment banking. So it's not that I'm not used to it. I was very much used to it. And I thought to myself, I don't know where this might lead to. It's definitely not in my career path. It's not the right way to do stuff. But I never know. And for me, that was the epitome of risk taking because I didn't really know where it would lead me. I didn't know that today this will be the story that I'm telling, that this is how my life evolved. And actually, I think that in everyone's careers, the story is something that's being built post-mortem. So after it happened.
Which is why I'm wondering why you would say it's not the right career move. Isn't it the most right? Aren't the career paths that are, you know, linear, sort of restricted?
I think they're not restricted. I think, you know, mind you, for perspective, I started my career in London. So, you know, it's very, very structured, very straightforward, very different to how we do business here, right? So if you go for investment banking, you start as an analyst, then you become an associate, a principal, a VP, then an MD. So, you know, you have your whole 15 years laid ahead of you. And sort of if you're willing to walk the walk, then great, then you'll get to, you know, the right rooms in due course. I just didn't have enough patience.
Yeah, it's almost depressing.
Yeah, so for me, it was actually a shortcut, but again, a very risky one.
We're excited to be collaborating with the Israeli website CTech, owned by Kalkalist, Israel's leading business newspaper. CTech is the gateway of the Israeli high-tech to the tech world and vice versa. If you're not already a regular reader, we strongly recommend that you check out kalkalistech.com, kalkalistech.com, to stay up to date on all high-impact stories from the Israeli tech scene.
Mary, so, like, it's shortcut. Also, you meet a lot of people and see, like, a lot of experiences, which is great. But you said something before about having the knack of learning a new industry or company in about 3 weeks. That sounds to me pretty impressive. So let me, like, what's the hack there? So you come up. So just to imagine the job itself. Okay. So these people come and pitch you the companies and you have to actually do due diligence and go through them and understand very quickly the strengths and weaknesses and whatnot and give an evaluation of, is it worth going forward or not? Right. And you said three weeks. So what's the trick of doing in 3 weeks?
So actually, there's no, it was pre-ChatGPT, so there was no quick way of doing it. But actually, for me, it was putting myself in their shoes. So I try to imagine that I'm them and that I'm actually experiencing what they are experiencing. And if I was now the CEO of whatever cyber company, then who is on my right, who's on my left, who's at the top. And for me, that was the best way because I felt their problems and what they need in order to solve them. So I actually there were some things that I took as granted. You know, they did their diligence, they did their business models. Okay, I would review them, but I would review them from the eyes of, you know, what would I do if I had to pitch it right now?
Wait, and
actually, this is what I had to do, right? I would then go out and pitch it to other investors. So I had to feel something inside to say, okay, this is what drives them. This is the passion. This is what makes them really unique. And then, you know, the rest of the diligence is reading, writing, you know, the textbook. Doing it 3 weeks is spending the first week trying to be them, basically.
Uh-huh. So you would gather the information, and then if you would get excited or think he was right, you would go and pitch it to other people, acting like as if it's yours, let's say, just for the fun of understanding it.
Yeah.
And then getting the feedback and seeing if you're correct, if it works or not. And if it didn't work, if you got bad, like specific feedback that's not perfect, but, you know, the idea wasn't awful, like, you know what I mean? Like, what if part of it worked?
And I think it's a very good question. And I think that this is what I didn't understand back in the day, is that there's a huge middle market. And the middle market is actually real companies with unique technologies, and they all have something of an added value to the market. So if the idea was not groundbreaking, but actually made financial sense, then it means that there is a type of investor that fits that company. They might not be the Sequoias of the world or the top VCs of the world, but they would be somewhere in that middle market range, which is very much, you know, neglected from the news, neglected from the top, right? Uh-huh. And that's where most businesses are. So most businesses are not the whizzes of the world. They're actually very good teams, very good ideas, who are doing step by step, trying to get somewhere. And in between, they need a lot of capital. And that capital is not necessarily VC capital. And that's where the companies would meet us.
That's fascinating, because we had a guest on our podcast, Rand Fishkin. He wrote a book, Lost and Founder, and he was criticizing Silicon Valley for glorifying all those specific exit-driven businesses and underestimating so many lifestyle businesses that could become very profitable and perhaps actually have a more promising business model. So it's fascinating from an investment banking point of view to be hearing that as well.
Actually, because the companies that I was dealing with were companies that already had revenue, etc. And actually, my degree, part of my degree was in finance. And I remember the 101 rule, right? Cash is king. And for me, that's always been sort of the driver. Show me where the profitability is, where the money is, where the bottom line is. And then, of course, with the promise, with tech, with all the fluff that surrounds it, let's build something sustainable. And actually, in a very, very funny way, but this is what led also our operation here at Safe House. We tried to build a good business, a good, growing, sustainable business that's, on the one hand, driving capital, on the other hand, creating growth metrics, but not actually just spending money for the sake of spending, but spending money to generate real growth.
That makes so much sense. And I'm curious, because it sounds like you accumulated so much knowledge and you sort of had in your toolkit what it takes to probably start your own venture at that stage. And you were even sort of mentally practicing, you know, like for a few years, you were putting yourself in those shoes and imagining that you're now the founder. So what led to actually, you know, taking the next corporate step instead of rolling up your sleeves at that stage?
So for me, what I really did, and this is how I actually ended up in meeting my other two co-founders, is I took six months out of my life. I said that for the next 6 months, I'm going to do only things that I'm good at and that make me happy without any relations or any direct correlation with how much it pays, the title that it is, and sort of how fashionable or how big it is. I did that because when I left Mellanox, everything felt like not a good enough opportunity. So I said, forget the opportunity. Let's take 6 months and just do things you like. At these 6 months, I actually spent three of these months at the Techstars Accelerator, which was back then it was Techstars and Barclays, the UK bank. And I was doing their work for the companies, actually as a part of the accelerator. I was doing work for the companies. I was helping the companies to build their business models, to build their financial forecasts, to try and create KPIs for their businesses, to try and mitigate the life cycles of getting new customers. And I did that for 3 months. I entered a 3-month contract specifically for that. And actually in real world, you know, I would never take 3 months to just do something because I'm just not that type of person.
And yet you did.
And yet I did it, yes, because, you know, I still created a framework around it. I'm taking 6 months out. And that's how I met my two partners. They were a part of the accelerator. They came with their idea already to their accelerator. And once we were done with the accelerator, it was quite clear that I'm the missing link and that I should join them as a co-founder. And for me, it was on the one hand, a risk mitigator because I've already worked with these guys for 3 months. We've already had our first fight. We know where each other's strengths are, where the weaknesses are. And that was a very huge de-risk factor for me. And on the flip side, they haven't raised capital. So we would go on the full-blown adventure together. So that was sort of what drove me to actually take that step, because the opportunity presented itself and actually I created that opportunity for myself. And that was about 7.5 years ago. Yeah, it's crazy to think that time flies.
It does, doesn't it? And then, I mean, you were the COO and now you're the CEO. So bridge that gap.
Yeah. So, you know, every startup goes through 7 phases of hell.
Wow. Like one per year?
Like one per day, really, actually. But in all honesty, one of my partners decided to leave after about 4.5 or 5 years. And I stepped up and I said, okay, let me lead from now on. Of course, it's a change of dynamics. It's a, you know, it's a different type of conversation with investors. And it was all done in a very, very professional way. And this is, you know, founder's fatigue, sort of real, real textbook founder fatigue after many, many years of hard work. It's really hard on the mental side. And then of course the war started, etc. So he was recruited to Miluim, but that's where I did the shift. And for me the shift was it was very natural because I knew every bit and byte of the company, and you know, I recruited the people. I knew all the contracts by heart. I was in very good relationships with the investors. So for me, it was very, very natural.
But you sometimes still, I mean, you're describing this as the stages of hell, right? and you had your comfy seat, you know, in investment banking, and you know, you went on your adventure exploring, and you know, working with Eyal. So do you sometimes miss that comfortable seat, or are you sort of hooked on the thrill? Like, where do you stand? How many people do you lead these days?
Yeah, so these days we're about 50 people. We used to be about 70, and we downsized from that. So that was a very painful experience. Actually, the hardest thing that I've done in my life, to let people go, and actually recover from that. For me, it's not that I'm hooked on the thrill. I'm just I'm a very pragmatic person. I like to do things my way. So I like leading. I like thinking about the next opportunity and finding the best people that are way smarter than me, that they know way better than me, and get them to the same table to speak, to brush out stuff, and to actually create opportunities for the company. For me, I had a dream, right, to build a big company, to grow it, to create impact in the society. And I think that even in my next journey, I'll still do the same, because this is something that I like. And it also gives me the ability to do things I like travel and be with my kids and set my own pace. And actually build a company that I'm proud of and create a culture that I would want to work in.
Well, there is so much to unpack here, because I am quite confident that many women listening right now would not assume much of what you've just said with respect to, you know, managing your own time, being with your kids, travel. It's pretty self-explanatory, right? I mean, I'm assuming you're traveling for business, but like, how can a founder of a very intensive venture with investors and a lot of people that you have to be accountable to, and teams that you lead, like, how are you able to create that work-life balance?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I ask it myself every day. But actually, I look at the startup as it's the journey of my life, right? It's the journey of the life that I chose. Actually, when I joined Liad and Adi, who are my partners, in 2018, I told them, I'm actually planning to start a family. I'm planning to start fertility treatments. And this is something that I'm planning to do. And for them, it was, they didn't have kids at the time. And for them, you know, it was like any other thing I said. They just said, oh, okay, fine. little did they know what it was actually going to be like. But my thought about it as a journey is that you never know how life will end up. So with my first child, there was COVID. We were working from home. I couldn't expect that in a million years. I didn't know that this is how it's going to be like. But I didn't want to give up being a founder, and I didn't want to give up, you know, being a mom. So I said,
that actually went to your, like,
to my advantage.
Purpose, but it went advantage. Yeah. Okay.
Of course, 100%. And back then, actually, we weren't very funded. So, or we actually just finished our seed round. So I brought a nanny to help me out, and I was involved from a couple of weeks after. And because it was COVID, I was able to do both things. With my second one, I didn't know that, but the atmosphere, what I did ahead of giving birth is actually I built an entire department to help me out, to take things that were my responsibility and to lead them. So I actually had the greatest experience of my life foregoing power, which is something, and foregoing responsibility. I actually had to trust someone. I had to bring people. I had to teach them because I had a deadline. And I think that for a lot of founders, female or male, there is a lot of issues with creating growth in the company because you're used to doing everything yourself. Here, I was lucky to be a female because I had a deadline. By that deadline, I had to create a sustainable structure that will flow without me. Now, it's true, things did come up my way when, you know, really, really urgent stuff came along. But that gave me the opportunity to build growth. And
did you feel that made you better in trusting people? Because it's a lot of trust issue. Like you probably had a great team. It wasn't like a...
Yeah.
They weren't incapable because you hired them, right? So right, what changed? Yeah.
So I had to bring, for that bit, I had to bring people that I trust. So it was people that I knew that I previously worked with. It was people that we had similar ways of looking at problems. And because they knew me, they knew when... you know, to float things my way and when they can just take it on and lead it themselves. And I think that that actually made me a better manager because I had to give responsibility. I couldn't I physically couldn't keep everything in my hands. So for me, it was great. And to your question, Noah, because I was one of the founders, I could dictate the times of the meetings. So for me, after 4 p.m., there were no meetings between 4 and 7. No need. Unless it's something urgent, investors, East Coast, West Coast. Okay, there's always times of high pressure, but... this is the life of a startup. It's not 300 at all times. It's like a it's like waves, right? You have a very, very peak season and then you have a bit of a slowdown, peak and slowdown, peak and slowdown. And for me, that's like in life. I knew how to take that and take advantage of that to create a balance in my life. And of course, I would not be able to do it without help, without my husband, who's also taking part in raising his kids that he brought himself. so that's, of course, the full package.
I speak with a lot of mothers who don't feel they truly have permission. And I think the permission is from themselves, first of all. To actually truly have a career. Like, of course, there's so many examples that go the other way, but you know, that balance is so tricky. So I'm wondering if you have any advice for mothers who have, you know, who want to fulfill themselves in their career and are thinking, I don't know, that entrepreneurship is off the table because that ship has sailed, or just in general, how can they take more, how can women take more ownership and more responsibility career wise and make it work without, you know, having, you know, without feeling that something has to give?
Yeah. So for me, a really exceptional thing that entered in my life around 2019 was a group of women that surrounded me from woman to woman of 8200.
We've interviewed Yulia, the CEO.
Yes. So Yulia is a force of nature. And when I met women who are like me, they want to achieve something, they want to do something, they've done something in their life, and they have further ambitions. And you see that it exists. It helps you in your journey because you understand that you're not the only mom that didn't go to playground today. And it's okay because you went yesterday or the day before or next week or the week after. And you have like-minded people to speak to about career, about growth, about opportunities, about fundraising, about real business stuff. And so I would say surround yourself with like-minded people. It can be men, it can be women. And I think that for women, the idea that one thing has to come on the expense of another is always the case. And the question is, for me, that's the way I look at things, is the question of the price. Every choice you make in life, it has a price. And if you're willing to pay the price, then fantastic. If you're not willing to pay the price, then maybe it's not for you and you should be doing something else. But if you are willing to pay the price, and the price is the price of creating a different set of opportunities for yourself. I personally am very happy with spending time both with my kids and going on a business travel. And the way I would advise women to do it is, if it's something that you want, just do it. And then you'll create the infrastructure that will enable you to do it and surround yourself with like-minded, potentially women or men, to do it. And the second thing that I must say that really sort of opened my eyes is that actually I feel that men are the same. They want the same thing, especially, you know, people that surround us. Dads, they want to be fathers as much as I want to be a mom. So I think it goes both ways. I think if you're creating a company, you need to create a company that will enable people to work and to have a life and to prioritize both of them at the same time, with, of course, the understanding that there's peak times and performances and, you know, deadlines and whatever, but create a space which is safe and good for everyone. And I think it would be very, very beneficial if men start taking maternity leave or paternity leave as well. That would actually be my dream. If I ever get an opportunity to influence and to create change, this would be the first thing I would do.
I think, by the way, in US, it's already like it's not that far. Your dream is very here, like
very much like so. In the US, in several companies, in Sweden, my brother, actually my older brother, lives in Sweden, and he was on paternity leave because it was mandatory by law, and it's a life changer because actually, fathers are aware of their kids. They spend time with them. They know what they miss if right now they're not at home. And actually, my partner took paternity leave of 1 month and spent the first month with the child and with me at home to get to know his baby that he created. And I think if more people do it, it would be fantastic.
I agree.
Definitely.
Would you encourage your kids to be entrepreneurs?
For sure. I think it's a way to fulfill yourself. It's a way to set goals for yourself. Things that, you know, 6 years ago, we told VCs that we would go on a cyber adventure and protect B2C customers. They told us, come on, guys, you've completely lost it, right? You don't even know what you're talking about. There's no industry. You'll never get even one client. And, you know, 4 million clients later, we created an industry. So I think it's something that I would encourage my kids to do, because it fits with, you know, create yourself a goal, find out how the best way is to get there, and try maximum. If anything doesn't work, maybe you'll fall, maybe you'll bounce back up. And that's the journey.
I think it's about bouncing back up, and in some form or other, you will fall along the way. And I think also, you know, the measurement of success, even if a startup fails, but there's so much learning along the way. So, you know, it's like you said to Eyal, I don't repeat the same mistake twice. If you do that, you're probably on a good path to do something significant.
Right. So I think that that is the journey of entrepreneurship. I think it's making mistakes, just making them very quickly and learning very quickly and bouncing back up again. And I think that it's very much the opposite of what we're being taught in like school and university, that there's the right way and the wrong way. And I think there's no right or wrong. There's just the way that you're going to do it, because this is the set of knowledge that you have at any given point in life. You can only take a decision that you see, that you know that exists. If you take it, it will lead you right or left, and then you'll decide what to do. If you see that it doesn't work, maybe you'll turn left. Maybe you'll turn left or right from that angle that you've taken. Actually, becoming a mother humbled me in a way that I understood that you cannot control the outcome. You can only control what you know at a certain time and do your best. If you did your best, then that's all. And I think that's the essence of being a CEO, a COO, an entrepreneur, is making decisions, making them quickly, learning from them quickly, and being humble enough to know that you can't control all outcomes. Go ahead.
So you can't control the outcome, but you can only control the perspective. Is that what you're saying? The way you look at it.
Yeah, right. You can control the perspective, and you can also control the amount of effort that you put in into whatever it is you're doing. You know, in retrospect, you couldn't have done anything different, because that's what you've chose.
Or at least, you know, to understand what you could have done different in retrospect in order to not repeat it.
That's what I'm saying. You can't, because back then you didn't know what you know now. Like if I were to set up a new startup today, I could only say, okay, these are the things that I want to take with me, because I think that these are the things that I want to keep and I want to foster moving on. But I actually don't know whether they'll have the same effect in a different industry with different people in a different business climate. I only know that they're good for me.
Oh, I agree. I'm just saying, you know, in order to not drop the aspect of responsibility among any assessment of what went wrong, and I'm sure you agree, that it's also about asking yourself, okay, what could I have done differently given the circumstances that I had?
100%. I take that as a given. The fact that I chose to be an entrepreneur means that everything is my fault. I take full ownership on everything, even things that are not...
And the mother.
I take responsibility for you, for him, for everyone, because that's what you do. You're the head. You are the responsibility bearer, taker, and you need to do whatever you can to fulfill what you attempted to do to begin with. And of course, looking at retrospect does not in any way imply not taking responsibility. On the flip side, with utmost responsibility, taking the best of what you did best and trying to figure out what would be things that you would leave out next time.
I love that.
Can you scare me for a second? So in your company, okay, so you're protecting B2C now, okay? What are the scariest thing you've seen in the internet right now happening to people?
So I've seen many, many Instagram influencers, people who use social media as their prime source of income, lose their job, get locked out of their account, have their details being compromised, and lose access to their own assets. And this is a very scary thing, I think, for a lot of people, because when it's your main source of income, it's very, very alarming. The second thing is, of course, financial damages that are happening to customers having their data leaked. So a lot of people are registering their credentials to many, many websites, to many services, and having your details out there creates a potential compromise. And I've seen people lose $300,000, $30,000. And actually, we've created a cyber insurance policy that would reimburse people for potential losses that they might have from basically being hacked. Of course, cyberbullying for children, which is a very alarming thing. And in general, exposure to behavior of children on the internet is something that occupies me quite a lot. It's something that I think we haven't created a solution which is bulletproof enough. And I hope that we'll still get a chance to continue and develop and do more on that front.
So on that said, so, okay, so as an aspiration, as an entrepreneur, okay, so if you were to do one thing impactful in your business right now, okay, and you can take this either as a woman, as an entrepreneur, as a manager, okay, what would be the thing that you'd say, I'm proud, and I'm not talking about money and valuations, I'm saying I'm proud of the thing that we did. I think it was the right choice and it's the right product. What would be that thing? Holy grail.
Wow. What a question. I think for me, it would be inclusion. I think that many people look at a startup industry as a very exclusive club that you can't join. And I think the more the company grows, the more inclusion needs to take place. Mm-hmm. And I'm not only talking about women, I'm talking about minorities from all sectors of society, Haredi people, Arabs, people from the periphery, the financial periphery. For me, if I could do one thing, is I would create as much as inclusion as possible. And I think it's very, very hard to do when you're just starting out and when you're small. And only mm-hmm. in my perspective, when you become bigger is the time where you can spend and dedicate to creating impact, which will in due course also drive financial, I think, financial benefit to the company. But for me, that would be number one.
What would you say your superpower is?
I would say I'm a juggler, so I don't let the balls fall. For me, juggling is the number one. I always know how to put the ball in the top, the one that doesn't need to fall, prioritize that. And for me, that's my real superpower, to be able to do everything, to feel that things are flowing, things are good, things are right. On the company level and on the personal level.
It's quite evident from this conversation, by the way. What would you say your kryptonite is?
I would say lack of transparency. So I think that when I think of success and I think how hard the journey is, when I share it with people who are experiencing the same thing, then it's easier to go through the path together with other entrepreneurs who are swimming in the same pond as you and are experiencing the same type of problems that you are. And for me, my kryptonite is finding people who they have it all figured out and everything's always perfect. So for me, that would be something that...
So your kryptonite is not finding another juggler?
No, for me, kryptonite is not finding someone who won't admit that one of the balls does fall sometimes because they're an amazing juggler and they do it the best they can. But every Iron Dome has a 0.0 chance or 0.02 chance of dropping the ball. And I think being able to admit it is the opposite of kryptonite. You can't admit it, that's a kryptonite for me.
I think in it's an artistic way of articulating the premise of this podcast. So it's about realizing that nothing is perfect and finding your way through that. With that premise in mind.
Yes, and actually normalizing it because this is the reality. The reality is that building a startup is a fantastic thing and it's hard in a million ways. And building your life and, investing in yourself, in your friends, in your mental health is something that we all have to do along the way, and that's the journey. And actually when I entered or when I realized that entrepreneurship is for me, I only saw the end goal. I saw the exit, I saw the IPO, that was my vision. I didn't realize that the life that's actually the startup. The startup is going through a day by day, not falling, seeing a new opportunity, creating a new opportunity, missing out on a few opportunities, and being able to admit that all this is a part of your success because your success is your journey. This is something that I think not a lot of people realize. And I think this is why Israel is full of very, very talented people, because success has many, many, many shapes and forms. And I think it's very evident here.
I agree. No,
it's super important to remember that Superman also goes to the bathroom.
Of course.
Miri, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. And we wish you lots of luck on your mission, because on so many levels, when you succeed, we all do, with inclusion and with protecting people digitally. And, you're aiming for good, and it's evident. And thank you for that.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a real pleasure. And I hope you continue spreading good.
Thank you.
And thank you.
Bye, guys. Thanks.
That's all for today's episode. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to our podcast so you never miss an episode. Also, if you have a moment, we would really appreciate it if you could rate and review our podcast on the platform you're listening to. This will help others find our show. And as always, if you know anyone who you think would enjoy our podcast, please share it with them. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back as usual on the first of the month.
Real. Live.
Superpowers.
Live.
Superpowers.